Good evening, everyone.
As you can see, Andy is our speaker tonight. And I think Andy is typical of this center of coming to responsible for family, challenging work, and technology, high-tech world, and exploring ways to accommodate this practice into that busy life. So maybe he'll be telling us about his experiences trying to do that. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Les. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. This is my first time giving a talk here, and so thank you very much for having me and listening. Just a little bit of background about myself. I started meditating in 2010 on my own and joined the Kanando Sangha in 2014. My professional background, I've been a product and a general management executive in tech companies is what I've done most of my life. We moved from Chicago to San Francisco about 4 years back, pursuing an opportunity to work in artificial intelligence. This space was very dear to me, and this is an area that I've wanted to work on for 15, 20 years, so it was an opportunity that I couldn't pass, which is why I moved here. Like many people here in the Valley, I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I actually like building products, I like building businesses, and I like the challenge of problem solving through products and bringing together a team of really smart people to work on a problem and do all the cool things that we do. This is essentially what work for me is, and this is what I've been doing for quite a long time. One of the key questions that I've asked myself for some time now is, why do we work? And is there any meaning to what the work that I do? This was a question that came up for me almost around 2009, 2010, which is when I started meditating. Why is this important? Is because if we think about this, we spend on an average 90 to 100,000 hours actually at work. Almost 35% of our adult life is spent working. However, if you think about this, less than 20% of people are actually very satisfied with the work they do. They come back home energized for about a day's work. A lot of us are tired, mentally and physically. It's a challenge, and I was no different. When we think about what we do in Silicon Valley, this just is amplified by significantly higher. It's a significantly bigger number. And the primary reason is we shoot for the stars, we want to predict the future, we want to work on really big things. All the challenges that drives us and that actually brings the smart people here to the Valley, it's actually a tough challenge, and then it just gets increasingly harder. Early on, I used to think about work very similar to how everyone else was. I was told that work is a part of life. You go to good school, get good grades. You go to good colleges, do well in college, get a job, learn from the best, and work hard and work harder and move up the ladder, and good things will happen. Very similar to what it was, and it did actually pan out for a lot of my early part of my career. But it really was not satisfying for me. Something was missing. I was asking this question, why am I not happy? Why is this not it? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Is this what I'm supposed to do for the next 20, 25, 30 years? And the answer was just not there, which was the primary reason I started meditating. So if we step back for a second and then look at why people work, and again, there's lots of studies around this. There's a couple of factors around this, right? So one is actually the external perception of the self. We actually make money to sustain a lifestyle that we want for ourselves and our families. The work actually gives us an identity It actually gives us a sense of position in the society that we live in. It actually, we are in control of our work, so we feel like we are, it gives us a sense of value for ourselves. And then there's the other part of this, which is the satisfaction of the inner self. We want to feel that we have contributed something to the team that we work in. We want to contribute, we want to feel that we have contributed to the company that we are part of. We want to feel that we have contributed to the society that we live in. We have created something or we have done something for our customers and so forth. This is actually a big part of why people want to work as well. A second thing is, which actually motivates humans, is pursuing a shared goal by working with others, right? So we actually don't, you know, if you look at it, we actually don't want to do everything by ourselves. We actually want to work with others, and then that gives us a sense of satisfaction as well. So when you, there are a couple of these categories of motivation as to why we work, but if you look all around us, most of the reasons why motivation, most of the motivation is primarily focused on the perception of the external self. We as employees crave for that, and organizations also provide primarily that, glossing over the need for the satisfaction of the inner self. And that seems to be, in my mind, a big cause for the suffering that we all have. Now, if you think about this, how much money is enough? How much of, selling a startup for $100 million is enough only to find out that your neighbor sold it for $300 million? And then the moment you do this, the question is, what next for you? It never stops. You try to go the corporate ladder, vice president isn't enough, president isn't enough, CEO of a $100 million company isn't enough, a $1 billion company isn't enough. How big of a team do you manage? This never stops. It really never stops. And just from an organization standpoint, the perception of the external self, the motivational factors, are again short-term things which makes us run harder in the short term. You know, close these number of deals and then you get this bonus. Do this project successfully, you get these stock options. These are, again, short-term goals. Never really helps build a company in the long run, which is built to last. This does not mean to say that financial incentives and motives are not important. This is definitely the world that we live in. This is super important for us. But it feels like there really isn't a balance when we think about work between the external perception of self versus how do you satisfy the inner self. And that is a big challenge. And that, for me, was after a lot of thinking about this, and it felt like that was a big challenge for me. And I'm sure, you know, I'd love to hear thoughts from people about how they feel about this too. So one of the things that I wanted to experiment was, why do we think about this, take a small mind approach to work? Why not take a big mind approach to work? And what it meant was, what does it mean to take a big mind approach to work? The first step is about, being our authentic self at work. It's very hard to be our authentic self at work. We try to fit into the culture of the company. We are told to do a job in a certain way. We're told that this is how you will fit into the company. If not, you're not going to survive. There has to be a place for us to be authentic, for everybody to be authentic in the work environment. If we allow the teams to evolve on their own, culture isn't defined by one person at the top just because they founded the company or that person is a CEO. Culture is an assimilation of how people actually come together. So if we allow people to come together and then discover what is going to work for them, how do you establish a level of trust and respect for each other? That would be a much better way of actually evolving and figuring out how teams work to achieve a common goal. That is the success for the team. And the last thing from a big mind standpoint is we can also think about this as, how do we converge the individual's craving or the need for satisfaction of the inner self against what we need to accomplish as a team? How do we bring this and then do things together as a team? I know this sounds a little bit idealistic in terms of a lot of fluffy things, right? In terms of, hey, you know, does this really work in the corporate world and how we want to do this? But there are some benefits to taking this approach, right? There are definitely some benefits to doing this. One is authentic employees are more committed. They are more productive. They are better workers. That is true. Teams that work well together serve customers better, and customers that get served well translates to better financial results. So there is it's a harder path. It's a different path than what we are all used to, but there is a path to this. And one of my favorite companies is Southwest Airlines. Anyone travel by Southwest Airlines? Okay. It's a fantastic company. The airlines business, if you guys know, is a very competitive business. It's a very commodity business. All that they are selling is seats between point A to point B. And there are so many different ways in which you could go and do this. And Southwest Airlines is a company that puts employee first. It's not customer first, it's employee first. When we travel by Southwest Airlines, you would see that their flight attendants are goofy. They crack jokes. They pull pranks on each other. They have a lot of fun, but they're also very responsible in their own way. Here's a story about Southwest Airlines, which is very, 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 very dear to, you know, what it is to be very authentic. A granddad actually received a call that his three-year-old grandson had been murdered in Denver. His daughter's boyfriend, live-in boyfriend, actually killed his grandson. And granddad was actually in Los Angeles, and he was desperately trying to get to his daughter right away. So he booked an airline ticket with Southwest Airlines, and then he ran to the airport, long lines at LAX security, and he couldn't get past anybody. He tried screaming, asking for help, and nobody said, no, go back to the back of the line. He had to weave through all of this, and then he got past that, and then he ran to the gate. And at the gate was the pilot and the gate attendant waiting for this person. He thought that the flight would have left long time back. At this gate was this flight attendant and the captain, and the captain said, are you Mark? We held a flight for you, and we're very sorry for your loss. They knew about this incident, and they held an entire flight of like 180 plus people because of one person. And they don't need approvals from management, head of operations. A pilot, a gate attendant can actually make the call. It's that level of empowerment of human values that is very different, which makes Southwest a very different company. Southwest Airlines is the most profitable airline. They have never laid off a single employee in their 45 years of existence in this kind of a commodity business. The reason why I highlight this as an example is it's possible. It's possible to be authentic, pursue our human values, and still be a corporation or be an organization that can sustain and be successful over a very long period of time. It requires conviction, and that's the hardest part. I've had my own experiments taking a big mind approach to work. So this is one of the many challenges that work with less on. One of my first challenges was changing my own leadership style. I grew up in a very traditional sense. You know, I was taught that, again, go to good schools, learn, go to top schools, da-da-da. And it was, for me, a leader had to be very strong, has to be a visionary, has to protect his team or her team, and protect them from bad news, be the provider for the team. And so that was the definition of leadership for me. And I pursued that for a very long period of time. And it was a huge burden. The burden of leadership was huge. It weighed on me significantly for a very long period of time. It was stressful. But I thought that is what leaders are supposed to do. Take on more work. Take on more stress. do this for the good of the people. And it was a very me-centric world of leadership. At one point in time, it didn't make sense to me. I just wanted to let it all go. I came to a realization that it was not all me. I was just one of the many pieces in the puzzle. Things just flowed through me. It was not all me. And that was a big moment of realization. It was a false sense of, self-worthiness, that you as a leader is the biggest contributor to either the success or the failure of a business or a product or any such thing. When I realized that, it was a huge sense of relief for me to basically say that it's not all me. My job is to do one part well, and then the rest of the things, allow things to flow through me and allow everyone else to embrace a very similar approach in the team. And the responsibility of building a business, the responsibility of building a product, the responsibility of making a successful team is not does not reside with only one person. It's not just me. It's with everyone else. My challenge then became, how do I allow that to happen? How do I get myself out of the way? How do I get, remove myself out of many of these things and allow things to come together? That was my biggest challenge. How do I take my ego out of any of these situations? An experiment that I ran within myself was to say, to be more vulnerable with my own team. I didn't need to be a Superman. I did not need to be a superhero with my own team. I became more vulnerable. I started saying, I don't know more. Instead of saying, I know, there are a lot of times in the day when I would say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know seemed to be the most common thing I would say. I need help was another thing I started saying. I would go to people and say, I need help. Can you help me with this? Can you help me with that? Another one that I said a lot was, I messed up. And it was very comforting to go and basically say, you know what, I'm human. I messed up. I messed up on this one. And then the flip side of this was, I would also go and ask people, how can I help? Go and ask everybody. It was very subtle, small changes that I made. But it seemed to have a very different impact on the team that I was working with. I was no longer, the distance between me as a leader and the team and the rest of the team just went away very quickly. It was a moment of realization that everybody was human, everybody makes mistakes, we need to support each other. Leadership is just one other role in this whole thing. And we started understanding each other. And then this behavior actually forced more of my team members to actually start saying the same thing. I messed up. This might go wrong. There was a level of vulnerability-based trust in the team. It was no longer about everybody holding on to, I am a superstar. It is like, no, I'm human. But the only way we can solve this is if we come together, we can actually solve many of these things without judging each other. It was a huge productivity boost, and it made the whole work environment a lot more fun and meaningful for everybody, including me. That was a huge, huge moment, and it changed the way I approached leadership. A second, I would suggest, was about self-managing teams. The way we run companies, we run teams. There's a hierarchy, whether it is an explicitly defined hierarchy of a manager with team player, individual contributors or not. This is a hierarchy that is set to solve any problems within that team. It really does not work like that. The manager is never really an expert on everything under the sun that the team's going to face, all the problems. How can teams be more self-organized? Depending on what the issue was, can the teams come together and then start saying, hey, I can do this, can you do that, and organize themselves very quickly, and then solve approach. Again, this experiment takes the individual out of it and hierarchical approach to how we manage teams, but to empower everybody to step up and then say, you know what, I had a problem. An interesting story happened when I was in my recent startup. We were an enterprise startup, and we had a big retail customer, an e-commerce site, in which our product was deployed. And there were about a million plus people who used our product on it every day. On a fine Friday evening around 5:30 p.m., when everybody was beginning to wrap up for the weekend, we just noticed that our product no longer existed on the customer's website. We were like gone. We did not receive any call. We did not know what happened. And we just said, what just happened here? At that point in time, the most traditional way of doing this is for someone senior to go take charge, be the quarterback, bring in the engineering team, trying to triage the problem, and try to solve this. But something magical happened. The team started organizing by themselves. Everybody started, you know, putting their bags away, went back to their laptops, and then started typing in stuff. And they started looking at, you know what, I'm looking at this data. I'm looking at that data. I'm looking to see if that is a problem. Somebody stepped up and started coordinating these efforts. And it was just magical. As managers, you just have to not be there and not get in the way. Let things flow. And my job then was literally to go get pizza for the team. Nothing more. Absolutely nothing more. And in like 2 hours, the problem was solved. The image that I had was, it was a firefight, but it was a beautiful firefight. It was like watching a symphony, you know, of triaging the problem, of people coming together. You know, nobody has a clearly defined role, but they just start playing their instruments, but it starts coming together. That magic of how a team came together and solved that problem was, again, you know, it gives me goosebumps when I think about that day. So again, you know, another way of, when we think about the big mind approach is, you know, discard traditional ways in which we have thought about old-fashioned way of how teams should be structured. There has to be this leader who's always the leader. It doesn't work like that. Let things flow. Don't stop. Let's see how things work. But the fundamental thing is, it needs to be, for this to happen, you needed to have a trust in the team. Otherwise, this kind of magic would have never happened in the first place. A third big topic of mine is performance management for teams in the corporate world. Yes, we run businesses. Businesses are expected to deliver results. Teams are expected to produce results. If there is a deliverable, you have to do this. If a sales team needs to hit their target, they need to do it. But more often than not, we judge teams very easily without understanding what actually happens underneath that. We never put ourselves in their position. Both leaders and peers, we just say that team failed to deliver. That team did not meet their target. This business is a failure. But we never ask ourselves, could we have done anything about it? How did I offer myself? Could I have offered any help? Did I understand the issues that this team was facing? Could I have helped in any way? Could someone else could have helped in any way? Putting ourselves in the team's shoes, asking these kinds of questions without judging them when they have a problem, reduces the risk of actually failure. We can actually salvage many things. At the end of the day, if still a judgment call has to be made about the business, about the team, you could still make it, but you could make that with the full confidence that you tried, you have put in your best effort, everyone put in their best effort, and this is an outcome that is not, it wouldn't have changed in any way. That would be a much better way of acceptance for everybody involved. When we don't put ourselves in someone else's shoes, but we are very, you know, when we are ready to judge them about their quality of work or the output that someone has provided, it's extremely, it might be a little bit more of the small mind approach when we think about this in a work setting. And then the last topic that I've been experimenting is one of the most difficult things that we do in corporate, which is letting people go. It's a natural part of many businesses. It's inevitable in a capitalistic society that people come in, people move out. But it's if you look at how it is done in most companies, it's very painful. It's not the best way in which you take someone's laptop away and then walk them outside the door. This was a person who was trustworthy colleague till yesterday. You trusted the entire IP of the company, knew about everything. One fine morning, they are completely someone else. I've been in situations where one of the changes, can we give somebody a heads up that maybe changes are coming? How do we prepare them? Can we have a much more humane way of even communicating it? Can we, instead of applying legalese, which is what many of the lawyers tell us to do, say this, don't say this, can we have a conversation as adults in this room to say, you know what, this is the reason. The fault is not yours. This is a problem. Can you have a conversation? Do we have enough time available to listen to them? A lot of times it's a very emotional moment for the person who's getting laid off. Can we listen to them? Can we give them a hug? Can we help them pack their boxes? Can we allow them to say goodbye to their friends with whom they have worked many years? What is wrong with them? Nothing changes. It's just a good humane way of actually touching people and thanking them for what they have done. Again, this is a least risk. It actually gets the company more goodwill. The former employees are better ambassadors. They stay in touch. They come back, and they come back to the team. It's a lot of good. It generates more goodwill than anything else. So, again, these were some examples of some of the things that I have been experimenting in my own work situation. And it's been very interesting results. It's changed me a lot over the last few years in terms of how I approach work. I've come to a point where every decision that I make, I think about the human cost of making that decision. I did not used to do that before. I could think about it from an Excel spreadsheet standpoint and say whether this makes sense or not. Now there are people behind this. There are people whose work and their passion and their interests lie behind what we do. So it's made me a better manager, leader, and honestly, it's also helped work in teams that are like fulfilling for both the teams that I work in, and a lot more great relationships beyond work. So it's a great win-win for everybody. The last point that I wanted to make was a lot of us, including me, we actually come to Conando as a refuge from the everyday work life. We get hammered and we come down, maybe recharge our batteries, go back into the real world. That again is exhausting. We just get beaten up. The challenge that I'm trying to do, and maybe a question for everybody, is can we take a little bit of our practice and try to do this at work? Maybe the way in which we communicate with others, maybe the way we treat ourselves at work, maybe the way we show respect to ourselves at work, maybe the way we make decisions at work. Can we try that out? Is a question that I'm asking myself and more and the team. So, thank you.
Big mind, work collaborative leadership style. And I think certainly it sounds like working for you or your company can be more pleasant than some of the leadership situations that I've seen in my career. But there's a sort of a stereotype that I think we have to sort of address in the Silicon Valley culture. I mean, it's sort of like the old saying, it's good for a king to be loved, but more effective for the king to be feared. And if you look at Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, Elon Musk, there's this sort of paradigm of the CEO who terrifies people into doing things that they didn't realize they could do. So I mean, we kind of have to ask ourselves, would Amazon and Microsoft and Apple and Oracle and Tesla be the companies that they are if they didn't have these sort of harsh, crazy people at the helm? The employees might be happier, might be a better place to work, but we have to face the question of whether the companies will really get the success in the sort of rough and tumble Darwinian marketplace in Silicon Valley.
I don't know the answer to that. But I can tell you this, I've lived that life. I delivered results. I have turned around companies. I didn't feel good. The experiments that I've run, it has not gotten me the kind of success that will put me on TechCrunch or anything. But this is more fulfilling. I come back and I sleep better. I can tell my kids the work that I do. I can, most of the people that I work with, they know my family. It's not any separate, my work life isn't separate from my other life. I don't know the answer to that, but for me, I'm fine this way.
I have a question, but first I have an observation from your question and your answer, which is that what's going to change that mindset of, you know, the winners are the most, like, you know, savage leaders is more leaders like Andy stepping up, because I swear, if you come in Silicon Valley and just start speaking about, like, people will flock to you. They will quit their jobs and come work for you. So what's going to change this will be compassionate, holistic-minded leaders that create jobs, because then there's that supply and demand for engineers also. And we saw that happen, like, with Google when they started offering free food and these perks. Other companies are like, well, I guess we have to do it too. So that's a little observation that I have.
So maybe, can I just say something? So in startups, we always talk about defensibility of a startup. Is this startup idea defensible? Can someone, Google, someone else, recreate this idea, put more money and deploy it and put the startup out of business? This culture-based approach is defensible. You cannot fake it. And if we are true to ourselves, you attract the same, the type of people that you want to, it becomes a defensible business. And to be candid, this is my con in terms of how do you do this, but still not give up the capitalistic mindset of being successful. Maybe that's what we'll find a way. But if we can bring the smart people together who share this value system, maybe we can do it.
I think you gave a good example with Southwest Airlines. It's possible to do both. Doesn't mean it's easy, because it's not often done. So we have this duality in our mind, right? But I think you gave examples that it's possible, right? So my question is basically, what's the best way to deal with coworkers or people who are very much in that jaded mindset because of the corporate culture? So I had a particular coworker who's in India, which made it even more complicated because I can't just go talk to them, right? And there was this project that we were supposed to work on together. And he said, oh, I have ideas for all these improvements we can do on top of the original project, right? And he CC'd all these high up people. And then I replied and I said, you broke the build. Can you please fix it? And he's like, oh, that can just be between us, right? and then it went on. So like the next day, the build was fixed, but it didn't run. I said, there's all these runtime exceptions, like you didn't test this, right? And he's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll fix it. And then I say, sorry, I didn't get around to it. And it went on for a week. And it had to get to the point where I had a director at my desk saying, platform just said that they're gonna escalate this to Jeremy King, our CTO, if this doesn't get migrated. I said, okay, look, you need to revert everything you've changed since August 1st, and I need to migrate this ASAP and get this going, right? And we were delayed by a full week. And when I tried to express the severity, he tried to kind of cover it up, like, oh, don't worry about escalations. It's those people's problems, not our problems. And, you know, just chill out. And I'm like, you're really not increasing my confidence that this is not going to happen again. So I was just like, really? And then I stopped the conversation. And I was just like, let me just get this going. I have a lot of lost time to catch up. But I noticed myself feeling resentful. Like, I have plans this weekend. I have a session. I have other things. And I'm tired of cleaning up other people's messes, but at the same time, I don't want to like cause a scene and go to their manager and all this. It's like, but I get that kind of the culture's created this, and you know, what do I do? Like, is it reasonable to say like I'm not going to work with this person for a while, or should I? I definitely need to tell my manager at least, because I need to explain why it's delayed. But it's like, I want a workable solution, you know. So I don't know. How to deal with that, really.
So I don't know if I have a solution for you, but here's one of the common mistakes that we do is we interact with people in the context of a transaction. We never try to understand them as a person before a transaction actually happens. Yes, this person is in India, but could you have picked up the call, phone, and spoken to this person to say, what's happening there? Or I heard this. We never interact with people to understand them as humans first. And that's why one of the things that we do in this team is hang out. Just come in, you know, after work or before work. And we actually, one of the things that we did in that team was go tell something that you've never told anyone else before. Share it with your team. And it was very hard for a lot of people. But just putting themselves out there. Some, you know, there were lots of people with their own personal problems. It had nothing to do with work. What is on top of your mind? And they would share. And suddenly, with just their human story, people just get connected. And when Bonnie calls, that person knows he's talking to the real Bonnie. Or, you know, it's a just different connection. These are typically considered as waste in the typical corporate world, to say, this is your deliverable, this is your KPI, you have X number of hours, can you do it by this time? If not, this is an escalation procedure. We overprocess. Many of these things can be caused, solved by culture. Culture is actually faster than process or resources.
Absolutely agree. I believe that this problem was caused by the culture. It was absolutely, and he's just playing into the culture. Pretend everything's okay, because it's not okay to admit a mistake. It's not okay, you know, I have to brush it under the rug, right? And so I guess what I need to explore is how do I change the culture, at least in my team, at least with the people I work with.
And how, you know, that how can I help is a really powerful phrase. It's very powerful. Random conversation, somebody is tired, we can go ask, how can I help? Somebody is stuck, how can I help? You might not be able to help, but just the fact that you're asking and you took time to understand that this person needed, might need some help, creates that connection. This again was a technique that I learned from one of my mentors. It creates an incredible amount of goodwill.
I'm not in the tech field, but I spend a lot of time thinking about the technology that's being created, and that a lot of it's being created by these companies that want profit and are kind of cutthroat. And so it makes me happy hearing about companies that are taking a different approach in business. I wonder what your thoughts were about. cultures and business creating those technologies. And if you work in artificial intelligence, so is that a real fear that should maybe be had? Or?
I don't think so. There is a lot of hype around this technology than actually substance. Even the best of companies, what we are working on is a narrow capability of replicating a very tiny sliver of what a human can do. So I think there is more hype around this topic than actual substance or fear mongering that's going on. But the point that you're making about being responsible should not be forgotten. The potential of a technology like this can be misused. Now, a very real life example is, let's say that you are in a market to buy a Honda car. We could hit you with ads which could quickly change you to go and buy a BMW and put you in debt. Now, no one's clearly saying that Anup should be doing that, but the capability of these systems is that there is a possibility to influence how people think, react. The fake news is a great example of some of that, right? So I think there's a sense of responsibility that we need to have about how these technologies are deployed, for what purpose, in what context. But again, this goes back to this, the topic that we're talking about. If it is all about how much the company is making, how many millions their employees are making, then all of these issues will never be discussed. We tend to debate, bang heads together and make decisions about product and technology. We need to have similar discussions in companies about ethics, about what we should do and what we should not do. There has to be contrarian viewpoints. It needs to have different viewpoints. And we need to have those kinds of healthy debates. It's not one person saying, you know what, that's the right thing to do, let's do it. It's not.
Do you think the significance of the product is contributing to some of the ego in the companies?
Oh, help me understand. What do you mean by the significance of the product?
Technology is such a hot topic, and what is potentially being created is such a hot topic, that it seems like there's extra ego involved in the tech.
Absolutely. There's a lot of ego in tech. There's ego involved everywhere in tech. And again, it is one of the challenges, right? And here's another favorite issue of mine. Silicon Valley has the most concentration of the smartest people around in the world, by far. If you don't think about the tech world. But the number of real-world problems that we solve is very small compared to the potential. The reason is we waste a lot of our technology talent, product and engineering talent, because we are not able to come together as a team. There's so much of wastage in technology companies about technology that gets built, never delivered, to your point. So if there's a way in which we can harness these things or bring together teams together, provide a sense of purpose for engineering, for product, for marketing, bring down the ego, we could actually do a lot more. We could solve more problems.
Thank you for your talk. What you described tonight, the experiment that you're trying and your company makes a lot of sense. And as you said, you were happy before, and now you're happier. So why do you think, related to also what Dave asked, why do you think most companies are operating differently? Since, we have the ability to create or invent a system that will make us happier, but that's not happening.
We get measured by what the society values in this, right? Yes, it makes us happy, but the measure of a business's success is what is the market value of the company? How much does it IPO? How big was the exit? That is the measure by which we live. And Silicon Valley, there's so much of talk about how big was the exit, how big was the technology, how many users does this product have, and all of this stuff. That's the echo chamber that we live in. Even if we realize our internal self, it is very hard to put this in practice, and I struggle with it every day. I struggle with this every day. How much ever I want to take my practice and think about it every moment, I would be grateful if I can do this 5 times in a day. Then the rest of the time, I'm just like everyone else. And it's extremely hard. It's very hard.
So Amy, just a few observations. You talked about failure. You talked about results. And you talked about, you know, going to school, you know, getting the best grades, going to the best school, learning from the best. My question to you would be, do you remember when before all of this was put on you? Do you remember that moment in your life when all of this was put on you? What did it feel like before then?
When
people started telling you that you should be doing this and you should be doing that, and right before that moment, what was your feeling? Were you happy?
Look, I didn't think, right? Because you're taught that that's the way to happiness,
uh-huh.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't think. You're just told, you know what, go study, get good grades. You know, when you do good in school, you get to the good colleges. You do this, and then you land a dream job, then it's great. There's always, you're chasing it. And you think that's what work is. That's what work is. Our work is defined by how much, you know, the work that you do, the how big of a company that you work, or how much money. Different people have different yardstick. But it all comes down to chasing a material or, you know, a real world objective of how the society values success.
Yeah, society values a result, not success.
Success
is a result.
Yeah.
Okay, and so is failure. Both of them are results. Now, it is the amount of attention, which is what value is, the society is putting on to a certain result.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I was trying to get at, when so much has been hammered into, you know, everybody, like, you know, for the past 3 years, all I've been saying is Nissan, 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 Nissan. Everybody's buying Nissans, right? I have my own opinion about Nissan, but I'm not going to share that. Despite not sharing it, I just shared it. But, you know, so it really takes a lot of careful detachment, I think, is the best way to put it, to step away from this. Because when I was growing up, I was told the same thing. But there's always been a rebellious streak in me, so I never went that way. And so I'm responsible for where I am. I don't hold anybody else responsible for that, okay? And the other thing that I would say was, when I was growing up, I was given all these things, but I was seeing a lot of failures. I was seeing people crash and burn. I was seeing people have heart attacks and, you know, go on drinking binges and just being unhappy. I mean, the person who was bringing me up, he would give me advice. And he had a gold mine, he had a diamond mine, and he was importing trains for the whole country. He was exporting fruit. And he had 7 bypass surgeries. And he used to sit down with, you know, this much whiskey on the dining table every night. 20 years, I remember this. But I'm just saying is that this is I mean, I saw the suffering when I was growing up. I was like, wait, this is the kind of suffering that this is going to bring? What's the point of living like this?
So, fortunately for me, I didn't have to go through that.
but
I was unhappy. I didn't know why I was doing this. There was definitely a sense of unhappiness. It was not fulfilling for me.
So, do you feel the same way now that you... The question I'm going to ask you again is, do you feel the same way that you did when you were a child? Now, do you feel the same way?
I don't know. I really don't know. Right now, I don't... as I said, it's... this seems, at a gut level, this seems more fulfilling. So that's the journey, right? And it's fine. As I said, sometimes I get confused myself, right? I want to do all of these right things, but then I also say, you know what? I'm doing all of this. Why can't I have a big success? And that goes back to the personal cravings that we have, right, for that materialistic outcome. And then I have to check myself to say, you know, again, that's not what this is about. And then just go back. Maybe it happens, it does not happen, but this is fulfilling. So again, it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a struggle. Every day is a struggle.
So there's a great study that was done at Stanford by a biologist, Andrew Robert Sapolsky, and he studied rhesus monkeys. And it turns out rhesus monkeys organize themselves very similar to humans. And what he found was the monkeys at the very top of the hierarchy are the least stressed. And it's the same thing you find in humans, actually. If you're talking about Larry Ellison and Bezos and all these guys, if you look at the guys that are at the top of their game, they're usually the least stressed. And it's the people that are lower down the totem pole that are the most stressed. You know, the shortest lives and the health problems, et cetera, et cetera. And so I thought about this for a long time. And my belief, and like your opinion on this, is that most great leaders share one common trait. They're not afraid to lose. They have this ability to play this game or do things without the fear of loss. And people who don't achieve great things, they hold on to this fear of loss, and it prevents them from giving their whole self to something. What do you think about this?
I completely agree. But it's very hard to lose that fear of loss.
Yes.
There are different studies. People who always have a safety net versus people who don't have a safety net. So it's not one size fits all kind of bravado. So I think that's why it's a very nebulous problem to solve. But that fear of losing that fear of loss, it is again part of a self-discovery journey. That's what I believe. Some people can fake it, but then when it really hits you, will you survive? And the chances are it'll hit you. and that's why there's a level of self-introspection and grit that you need to have to actually go through that.
Do you think that the Zen mindset, the Zen principle of you can't lose anything because of everything you need you already have, do you think that's something that you fall back on? Is that something that's comforting when you do face, you're sitting at home and all of a sudden you get the letter from the lawyer and you're being sued for $10 million or whatever it is. You have the big stress in your life. Is that something you think about?
So not right away. I react like most humans do when I first get it. It's like, oh my God. And then I have to sit. I have to step back. And then I have to stop reacting to it. And then it's okay. We'll find out. And then a creative solution will pop up. But that has required, I needed a lot of training to get to that point. I just cannot say, oh, that's fine. I'm not there yet. Thank you.
What would you have any advice for somebody who's not in a managerial position or somebody who's an employee who, I guess, doesn't call the shots about the work environment, but they find themselves working in a very unkind or inhuman environment? Can they do something from...
I actually think we can all do everything. This concept of managers should actually go away. It's redundant in the world that we live in. This hierarchy was actually created when we had information asymmetry in the workplace. The manager had more information than the person who was working on, and so had to distribute work. It is a very industrial revolution-centric way of doing things. It makes no sense. The manager is required to make different decisions compared to someone who is on the team. That's the only difference in organizations are. So the answer to your question is, everybody is empowered to change.
But what if your manager doesn't believe that?
Manager, you don't care. The manager does not have... It does not matter. You can make an impact in every interaction you make with your manager, with your fellow workers. There's nothing that the manager can come and stand between you and someone else.
Theory of how to manage at least research. I don't know how much this could generalize other areas. He would have a lab that would have on the order of 100 people, and they all, as far as the organization is concerned, they all reported to him. There was no permanent hierarchy in his lab. There would be projects, and there would be project leaders. But as soon as the project was done, everyone went back into the pool of available talent to a new project and stuff. And so you never found yourself in a situation of saying, well, the database group with its manager just finished doing this database project. What database project shall they do next? And so forth. And in this way, there was the necessary structure for coordinating the work that was going on. It was all focused on the work, not on the status and power of the people involved. Of course, this whole thing was embedded in a large corporate culture that rejected it as a foreign body, and the whole thing was expelled at high speed. It was an extremely effective way of managing. Make the structure, Conway's law, which says the structure of any system resembles the org chart of the organization that built it. And this was a sort of antidote to Conway's law, where the structure of the organization was modeled on the structure of the work to be done. Very effective.
Thank you, David.
I have a few comments because I could relate a lot to that. I just want to say that a lot of that power imbalance is very illusory, and it seems very real, but like Andy pointed out, I mean, yes, you're dependent on your manager for certain things, your reviews and this and that. But also, we can't forget they're dependent on us. A lot of times we know the details a lot more than they do. We know the technology or we're interfacing with this other team, and if they can't succeed without us. And if they're not getting good reviews or you're asking them to transfer to a different team, like that, then they're failing. And so sometimes managers who try to do this power play, a lot of times, after a while, it'll hold up for a while, the illusion, and they'll make people look bad, but after a while, they get enough complaints from the people underneath them, the people leaving, that then they're the ones removed, you know, in a just system. But there are some exceptions, like sometimes there's visa issues. You're stuck with this one small company or something, and you can't move or something, then it might become real, or, you know, you're undocumented or something. I mean, there are some situations where there is a real power imbalance, but... a lot of it is very illusion, just like created illusion. And really, although you're dependent on them, I found that they're very dependent on you. We don't see that part. Mm. So thank you.
Yes, it's 9:05.
Yeah.
Oh, Teresa.
Yeah, you mentioned the case of Southwestern Airlines as an example of a company that has different principles, but is also very financial, very successful financially. So, in that sense, how happy are you with your company, the way your company is doing, and you know, is your experiment also being successful from the financial point of view?
It's reasonably successful, but not by, you know, but it's very young. But here's also the flip side of this. We think about the time frame that we think about is not 1 year, 2 years. These are principles that need to be foundationed. So this again goes back to how we want to build companies. Do we want to build companies for the long term? Do we want to attract that? That requires a different mindset, investors, employees, management. In Silicon Valley, there's lots of companies which are designed to be flipped in 2-3 years. You cannot run an experiment with that kind of a strategy. So again, if we are able to take a long-term view, then the results you have a chance that the results will be favorable. Oh, sorry.
So you were talking about the measurement of how company success versus like being compassionate, being a good leader. How do you think it's conflicting with each other? The execution capability versus like if a leader being compassionate, are they able to, do you think if a compassionate leader can achieve similar level of execution?
I actually believe now that a compassionate leader will deliver better results. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just you. You are not responsible for this company's success. It's the entire company which is responsible for its success. And you're now able to channel the entire team for your success. You just have to step out of the way.
People like Jeff Bezos, they don't look like...
I don't know. I don't know personally Jeff Bezos into how he operates. But look, I think an example of Silicon Valley company is Jeff Weiner, LinkedIn CEO. He practices compassionate leadership. You know, again, that's a great example of how he approaches the company and how he wants to grow the company. So I'm sure there isn't. This might not be the only solution to be a successful company. I'm sure there are many different ways. There is a Madoff. There is a Bezos. There are others too. But at the core of it, when we want to do something, what resonates with us? For me, those things don't resonate anymore. I'm not able to build a company that way. I'm not able to be part of a company that is only focused on that. I would rather be part of teams where I can share these as my core values.
I like that.
It helps me and everyone that I work with a lot more fun, a lot more engaging. It gives a better, bit more meaning to for me to spend long hours in doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you for hearing the story and your experience, and thank you for your enthusiasm.
Thank you.
Do you have any announcements tonight?
I have a question.